Seagulls circling above the wake. Bait your hook, Alex told me. He brought a bucket of live shrimp, translucent gray things that snapped and jumped in the lukewarm water. I hated the way they felt, like slimy fingernails. My 12-year-old mind couldn't comprehend why adults would ever want to eat these things. I pinched one between my fingers and proceeded grimly to impale it on the hook, its crescent body just the right shape. Put the point through the brain, my father would have advised me. That little black dot, don't worry, it can't feel anything. I trained myself to bait a hook without flinching, but whenever I did so, I felt like I was deadening my own brain, forcing myself not to feel. It was just a stupid shrimp. Its entire nervous system consisted of a gray line and a black dot and a colorless body. Why should I care? Alex cast his line. Old man giving you a hard time? He sounded almost sympathetic, but I didn't trust him. I was pretty sure this was some kind of setup, a prank that Alex and Garrett would laugh about later. Yet I didn't want to go back to the island. I didn't want to see my parents.
Didn't they tell you? Alex asked.
Tell me what? He studied me.
Not my place. Ask Garrett.
He might as well have told me to ask God. I figured I'd be more likely to get an answer. We fished until the sun began to slant into my eyes. Alex hadn't brought any bobbers, so I couldn't tell if I got any bites. He said he didn't believe in bobbers. He could feel a tug on the line just fine, couldn't I? The ocean toyed with me, plucking my line like a guitar string. Every swell was a false alarm. I reeled in and found my shrimp still impaled on the hook. I had just recast when something scraped against the hull. At first I thought we'd run into a sandbar. Then I looked off the port side and saw the beige tip of a fin going underwater.
Shark, Alex told me calmly.
I dropped my fishing pole as if it had become an electrical line. I scrambled away from it, trying to get to the dead center of the boat.
What are you doing?
Alex demanded.
Shark,
I repeated.
Jesus.
Alex leaned over and saved my fishing rod from getting dragged into the water.
We're in a fishing channel. Lots of blood and guts from the big boats. Of course there are sharks. Take your rod.
I just stared at the water. It was calm and green, no sign of anything stirring underneath.
I want to go back.
Suit yourself, Alex reeled in my line. My shrimp had been nibbled into a fluffy gray mass.
Your parents are getting a divorce.
What?
Your parents, they're getting a divorce.
No, they're not. Alex didn't argue. He could probably see the impact his words were having on me. For months, I'd known something was wrong. My dad's angry outbursts, my mom's evasiveness and tears. Then there'd been the scene in the hotel room.
He's been screwing around, Alex said. Nothing new. Garrett's known about it for years. Your dad's a drunk, a dirty old man.
That's not true, which was a stupid thing to say. Alex laughed.
Yeah, whatever, Trace.
Anger built up in my throat. I'd heard Alex brush me off too many times before, whenever he and Garrett played a cruel joke on me because they were bored.
My dad's better than you, I said,
my voice cracking.
Yeah? I saw in the lighthouse.
I should have known from the steely light in Alex's eyes that I was entering dangerous territory. I needed to stop.
You get high and carve girls out of wood, I said. Who are you making up there, anyway, your girlfriend?
Alex grabbed me by the shirt collar and pitched me headfirst into the water. I came up spluttering. Salt water burned in my nose and my eyes stung. I dog-paddled frantically, clawing for the side of the boat. My shoes weighed 1,000 pounds. I knew the shark must be close, already crazed from the smell of fish blood. Alex looked down at me. His face was cold and harsh.
Don't ever, ever mention that again.
You can swim home.
Do you want to swim home?
I couldn't answer. I couldn't even beg. I tried to grab the side of the boat, but my hands wouldn't work. Alex swore in disgust. He grabbed my shirt and hauled me, soaked and trembling, into the boat.
When we got back to Rebel Island, Garrett was waiting for us on the dock, scowling as I trudged ashore, dripping wet.
"What the hell happened?"
he asked. I was too ashamed to speak. When Alex explained, I expected Garrett to bust out laughing like he'd done many times before, but this time Alex seemed to have gone too far, even for Garrett.
"You fed my little brother to the sharks?" he demanded. "What the hell for?"
He and Alex began to argue. Under different circumstances, this would have pleased me. Garrett was actually standing up for me. At least, he didn't think I quite deserved to be shark bait. But watching him and Alex yell at each other, all I could think of was my parents. The way they'd been at each other's throats the past few weeks. The idea that their marriage was over.
"Stop!" I yelled. "It was my fault!"
I didn't wait for a reply. I ran, and I didn't stop until I reached the northern tip of the island. Alex and Garrett stayed mad at each other the rest of the weekend. I refused to speak to either of them. I never explained to Garrett why Alex had pushed me overboard. Neither Garrett nor Alex ever mentioned the incident again. As for me, I did not develop a lifelong fear of sharks or deep water, but I never forgot the shock of asking the wrong question of the wrong person and getting pitched headfirst into the warm sea with the blood and the sharks. For my last 10 years as a private investigator, every time I interviewed someone or prodded for information, part of me was that 12-year-old boy, and I imagined myself holding tight to the edge of the boat so I couldn't get surprised again.
"Señor?"
Jose was back, smiling blandly, holding the registration cards I'd asked him for.
"You are fine, señor?"
"Yeah," I managed. "Great." I took the cards and began flipping through them. The first was in my handwriting, Mr. and Mrs. Navarre. I stared at it, marveling at the weirdness of there being a Mrs. Navarre. I flipped through the other cards, went back to one of them, checked it against the phone records. "Here," I said.
"Señor?"
"3 calls to this number from the hotel, all in the last 2 weeks."
"Is that bad, sir?"
"I don't know." I held up the registration card with a name, a Kingsville address, and a phone number, all written in neat block letters. "But I think I should ask Benjamin Lindy." Chapter 18. Garrett found Alex in the parlor, staring at the marlin above the fireplace.
"Yo, Huff!"
Alex's shirt had a tear in the back, like it had snagged on a nail. Plaster and dust speckled his curly hair.
"You sure you don't want to buy this place?" he muttered. "Price is getting cheaper by the minute."
His tone reminded Garrett of another friend, a fellow programmer who climbed out onto the 10th-story ledge of his Bee Cave Road office in Austin after the high-tech bubble burst. The guy's voice had sounded just like that, fragile as glass, right before he jumped.
"You're gonna get through this, man," Garrett promised.
Alex turned. He was holding his old whittling knife, the knife his dad had given him for his 13th birthday. The blade was folded against the handle, but it still made Garrett uneasy.
"I was wrong to bring you all down here," Alex said. "You said you needed help. I'm telling you, man, Trace can help." "It's too late. I've screwed up too much."
Garrett remembered the body in the basement. A shiver ran up his back. Even so many years after he'd lost his legs, there were times he missed being able to run away. Down in the basement had been one of those moments. The way Trace had calmly shone a light over the dead man's face, gone through his pockets, and completely ignored the dried blood and the gunshot wound in the chest. How did little Trace, the annoying kid who used to complain to Mom whenever Garrett so much as touched him, grow up being able to examine dead bodies?
"Alex, if there's something you ain't told me..."
"Shit, Garrett.
You couldn't even start to guess. That stuff about Calavera. If you had anything to do with that, I mean, you'd tell me, right?"
Alex's expression was hard to read. Fear, maybe even shame.
"You remember Mr. Eli's funeral?"
Garrett nodded. It wasn't one of the days he liked to remember. He'd come down to Corpus for the memorial, mostly to console Alex. There hadn't been many people there, which had surprised Garrett. After all the people old Mr. Eli had helped, all the good things people said about him, Garrett figured there'd be a mob scene. But it was just Garrett, Alex, and a couple of ladies from the local Presbyterian church who seemed to have nothing better to do. Afterward, Alex and he had gotten blind drunk at the Water Street Oyster Bar.
"You promised you'd be there at my funeral," Alex reminded him. "I was drunk, man, and you're really starting to freak me out."
Alex put the knife back in his pocket.
"I'm going to get a drink."
"Don't think you need one, man."
"This coming from you?
Sorry, Garrett, I need a drink."
"Alex,"
Garrett called after him.
"You didn't kill anybody. You couldn't do that, right?"
Alex's eyes were as dead as the fish on the walls.
"I'm sorry I got you here, Garrett. It's going to be just like Mr. Eli's funeral. Nobody's even going to remember I did anything right."
After he was gone, Garrett picked up a pillow and threw it at the wall. That didn't make him feel better. He thought about how long Alex and he had been friends. Seemed like forever. They'd gone to concerts together, howled at the moon from the roof of this old hotel. When Garrett had lost his legs, Alex was the first one to come find him in the hospital. One of the few friends that stuck with him and never made him feel like a freak. Garrett didn't like what he was seeing tonight. He wanted Alex back the way he used to be. A pain in the ass sometimes, but fun. Admirable, even. Alex was the guy who always knew the right thing to do. Hearing him talking now about screwing up.
No.
That was Garrett's job. Alex was supposed to be the smart one. Suddenly, Garrett wondered where Lane had gone. They'd been apart like 5 minutes, and already he missed her. Alex, in the old days, would have had something to say about that. He would have warned Garrett against falling too hard. Garrett probably needed somebody to remind him of that. He had trouble thinking straight when it came to Lane.
"Hell with it,"
he muttered. Maybe he didn't know Alex as well as he thought. And if you couldn't know somebody after 30 damn years, who's to say you couldn't get to know someone just as well in one day? He wheeled himself out of the parlor and went to find Lane. Chapter 19. I finally located Mr. Lindy in a room I never knew existed, a small library on the third floor. Judging from the limestone fireplace, the place was directly above the parlor. The shelves were lined with tattered hardcover bestsellers from 20 or 30 years ago, Ludlum, Trevanian, guidebooks. Lindy sat in a leather recliner facing the door, a good defensive position. He still wore his dark suit, though he'd loosened his tie. His demeanor was so formal that even the small concession to comfort seemed like a shocking breach of decorum. He was flipping through a copy of Field and Stream, but I got the feeling he wasn't paying it much attention. His cologne filled the air with a faint amber scent.
"Mr. Navarre," he said.
"Mr. Lindy, we need to talk.
Then you might as well sit down."
I sat across from him, on the arm of the sofa. It was the only way I could have a height advantage. Lindy set aside his magazine. That's when I noticed his .45 in his lap.
"If the gun bothers you," he said, "I can put it away."
He sounded courteous, but I wondered if there was a veiled warning in the offer, as if the gun is the least of your problems.
"What's your interest in Calavera?" I asked. "Aside from the fact that he may be a direct threat to our lives, aside from that."
Lindy glanced at the ceiling. Even here, in the middle of the house, I could hear the storm blowing strong. Footsteps creaked above us. I wondered if Alex was up in the attic again, blocking off some section of the roof that had been torn away.
"I'm curious," Lindy said. "What makes you believe I have a personal interest in this killer?"
"There it is again."
"What?"
"The way you said personal. I didn't say your interest was personal. Earlier you said you'd retired before Calavera started murdering innocent people. Innocent people. Most of Calavera's hits were mafia men. Only his last hit, his big mistake, killed innocent people. You've got some personal stake in the Peter Brosses case, the murder of Brosses' wife and daughters. You slipped that envelope under my door. Lindy studied me, his eyes as bright as broken glass.
If you were right, would it matter?
What do you mean?
We have a murderer in this hotel. If he's allowed to leave the island, he will disappear. Now that you know who he is, you must agree he has to be caught. Given our circumstances, you may be the only one who can do that. Does it matter who gave you the information?
His tone was calm and reasonable, but he said the word murderer with an intimate loathing, the way a preacher might say Satan.
Why are you here? I asked. Why did someone at the hotel call you 3 times over the last week?
I came to fish.
Lindy pointed to the field and stream.
For Calavera?
I'm an old man, Mr. Navarre. I'm in no shape to track down a murderer.
Which I noticed was not exactly a denial. Did you know Marshal Longoria?
Not well.
Which means you did. Lindy's gaze wobbled, as if he were looking back through decades.
I once asked his advice on a personal matter. He counseled me as best he could. That was many years ago. I wouldn't say we were friends.
What was the personal matter?
I don't see that it is relevant.
Your family? The muscles in his jaw tightened.
My wife.
I waited, but Lindy wasn't about to draw water from that well. You knew Longoria would be here this weekend, I said.
He had reason to think Calavera would be on the island.
How can you be sure?
Chris Stowall's business card and the candy skull were in Longoria's suitcase. There was a note written on the back, June 5th.
That seems slim evidence.
I also found an email stuck in Chris Stowall's diary, part of a correspondence between Calavera and a U.S. Marshal named Barry, Longoria's boss. I couldn't tell if that surprised Lindy or not, but he seemed to be composing his thoughts before he spoke again.
What was the nature of this correspondence?
I think Calavera was negotiating surrender. He wanted to offer testimony against his employers, probably in exchange for a new identity and federal protection.
And why would he make such a deal?
The Brosses' hit at New Year's might have shaken him up, made him remorseful. Lindy shook his head.
Mr. Navarre, an assassin like Calavera has no remorse. More likely his cartel employers were unhappy with his failure to kill Peter. Calavera was bargaining information to save his own worthless...
Peter, I noticed. First name. Lindy stared at me.
Slowly, he nodded with grudging appreciation. You missed your calling, sir. You should have been a trial lawyer.
I married one, I said. That's good enough.
If you think Calavera could be shaken up, if you think he had any conscience at all, you clearly haven't read enough.
He picked up a yellowing newspaper from the table and handed it to me. It was a copy of the Kingsville Record, Lindy's hometown newspaper, dated almost 3 years ago. Before I could ask Lindy what this happened to be doing here, there was a tentative knock on the door. The maid, Imelda, stepped into the library, looking frazzled.
Excuse me, Senor Navarre. It's your wife. I think you should come.
Maya was lying on her side, a pillow between her legs, two under her head, one hugged against her chest. She looked uncomfortable and a little pale.
Too much excitement, she said. That's all. She is having mild contractions, Imelda said. Pre-labor.
I tried to keep my panic from showing.
Are you sure, Imelda? I've had children, senor, she said, like it was a subject she preferred not to talk about. The senora needs to rest and be very still, or she might deliver.
Be calm, I told myself. Keep it upbeat. You can't deliver on Rebel Island, I told Maya. I want our child to have U.S. citizenship. Imelda looked confused.
But, senor, this is... He's teasing, Imelda, Maya said. Trace, the baby is fine. I'll be fine.
We're all fine, I agreed. Sure.
Maya sighed.
Imelda, could you find some more pillows for my husband? I think he's going into labor.
Imelda looked more confused. But she's teasing, I said.
Ay, too much teasing, Imelda scolded. You should rest, senora. Perhaps some red raspberry leaf tea?
That sounds wonderful. Can you do that?
We have some in the kitchen, senora, and a portable heater for the water.
She fussed with Maya's pillows a little more, then trudged off to get the tea.
Don't go anywhere, I told Maya.
I followed Imelda and stopped her in the hallway. Hey, I said, keeping my voice down, if it came down to, you know,
delivering the child, senor?
Yeah, could you help? She tugged nervously on her wedding ring, which I didn't figure was a good sign.
I would try, senor, but this is the senora's first child. She is older. There could be complications.
How many children do you have?
Two.
Grown?
No.
Oh. Imelda twisted the cords of her apron. She had brown hair streaked with gold and white, like marbled fudge. If her husband's face was fashioned for smiling, Imelda's was made for stoic suffering. She had the pinched expression and weathered skin of someone who might have spent her life toiling in the fields, squinting against a hot sun.
I will help if I can, she told me. I have done it before back in Mexico. I think I could. I remember.
Thank you.
I will get the tea.
And she shuffled off like the hot fields were waiting, just at the bottom of the stairs. I sat on the bed and massaged Maya's feet. Her ankles looked swollen. I tried to remember what that meant. A normal thing, a danger sign. Maya and I had agreed on one thing about the childbirth process. The standard how-to advice and facts about what happened when stayed with us about as well as Japanese VCR instructions. Early on, Maya had decided to listen to her body and just go with that. What the doctors had to say was too scary anyway. She'd refused amniocentesis. Too risky. There was nothing it would tell her that she really wanted to hear. The baby was at high risk for muscular dystrophy. We both knew that. Maya carried the genes, 50-50 chance our child would have it. The possibility of MD was like the loaded gun Maya kept in her underwear drawer, or the blackmail file she kept on her enemies. We both knew it was there, we knew it might come into play some day, but there was no use talking or worrying about it, so we didn't. At least that was the theory.
Take my mind off the cramps, Maya said. Tell me what's happening.
A murderer running loose in the hotel was the last thing I wanted to talk to Maya about, but I could tell she needed distraction. Her conversational tone was forced. I'd never seen her look quite so worried, or rather, try so hard not to look worried. I kept massaging her feet as I told her about my trip to the boathouse, the bag of money, then finding Chris's diary and email to the U.S. Marshals Service. I told her about my conversations with Jose and Benjamin Lindy. Maya focused on my words the way she did in Lama's class, as if this were another breathing exercise.
You really think Chris is the killer?
I don't know what to think. You met Chris. Does he strike you as a bomber?
Bombed, perhaps, not a bomber.
Exactly.
Maya pressed her toes against my hand. But it certainly looks like Chris was talking with the marshals. And the money makes it look like he was planning an escape if things went wrong.
If Chris brought Longoria here, why would he kill him?
Perhaps Longoria reneged on the deal.
Doesn't make sense, I said. I know this other marshal, Barry. If I were him, trying to negotiate a delicate surrender, Longoria is the last person I'd send. Longoria would never let this guy Calavera skate. He'd kill him first. Barry certainly wouldn't send him alone.
And yet Longoria came here, alone.
I nodded. It made about as much sense to me as childbirth manuals. Or maybe I was just too tired to think. As I sat on a comfortable bed with Maya, my body was reminding me just how long it had been since I slept. I had no idea what time it was, close to midnight, probably.
What's in the newspaper?
Maya asked. I looked at the copy of the Kingsville Record that I'd set at the foot of the bed. I'd completely forgotten about it.
Old news from Mr. Lindy, I said.
We don't want to know.
Sure we do, she said. Go on.
And so reluctantly, I picked up the paper. The story Mr. Lindy had wanted me to read was easy enough to find. It had been front-page news in Kingsville 3 years ago. The meeting was held in a closed club called Gatsby's on the north side of Kingsville. Someone, perhaps to prove they'd actually read the Fitzgerald book in high school, had duplicated the eyes of Dr. T.J. Eckelberg on a billboard outside. The parking lot was marbled with weeds. The front doors were elegant mahogany with beveled glass, which didn't fit at all the plain white building that might have been anything, a warehouse, a beer barn, a pawn shop. Three cars arrived within 15 minutes of each other. Two new Mercedes sedans, each with Coahuila license plates, and a red Ford F-350 that belonged to Papa Stoner, one of South Texas's most notorious middlemen in the heroin trade. Stoner was 62. 33 of those years had been spent in prison. He was called Papa Stoner because he had a son, Eduardo Stoner Jr., who had gone on to an illustrious career as a gang leader on the south side of San Antonio. Eduardo had been murdered by rivals shortly before his 25th birthday, but Papa was still proud of him. He'd avenged himself ruthlessly on his son's killers, and still wore Eduardo's name tattooed on his arm, encircled in snakes and flames. Papa Stoner came to the meeting alone, unlike his guests. Mr. Orozco and Mr. Valenzuela each brought two guards. Traveling with any less would have been suicide for such important men. They met in the restaurant's bar, which still smelled of stale beer and cigarettes and lemon furniture polish. Papa Stoner had personally inspected the place that morning. He'd found no traps, no wires. He'd taken care of bribing the right cops to make sure their meeting wouldn't be disturbed. When you're entertaining guests from across the border, after all, you want to show them hospitality. Orozco was the nervous one. His operation was still small. This was a bold play for him, going behind the backs of the major cartels. He dressed too well for the meeting. An Armani suit, leather shoes, a new Patek Philippe watch. His hair was parted in the middle, well-oiled, so he looked a bit too much like a maitre d'. Valenzuela was older, more confident. He wore beige slacks and a white guayabera, as he did every day. He was a large, messy man with unkempt hair. Everything about him suggested disorganization. But he ran one of the tightest drug operations in Central America. Not a kilo escaped his notice, and he never forgot a name or an insult. The men talked for almost an hour. They agreed that the border war between the cartels was a major opportunity for smaller players. They could form a new pipeline, quadruple their profits within the year. With the cartels at each other's throats, the border could become a free trade area, a NAFTA for drugs. Stoner just about had Orozco and Valenzuela convinced. Everything would be fine. They didn't need to fear reprisals. Orozco started to relax. Lunch arrived, specially catered from Stoner's favorite Kingsville deli. The four guards took the meal boxes from the delivery boy at the door. Valenzuela and Stoner were breaking out the cold beer when Orozco's phone rang. No one knew where he was. Only a select group of people had his mobile number. He answered the phone. A man's voice said, "Go to the bathroom." The line went dead. Orozco hesitated only briefly. He'd been in the drug trade most of his life. He knew that some things went beyond logic. Most people would ignore something like a random phone call, but Orozco's gut instincts had saved him dozens of times. He excused himself from his colleagues and went to the restroom. He was standing at the urinal when the restaurant exploded. The restroom door blew off its hinges and smoke billowed into the room. Orozco dropped to the tiles and curled into a ball. He was shivering like a child when he stood up. He looked into the dining room, which was now in flames. Papa Stoner, Valenzuela, the bodyguards, all sprawled motionless on the floor, their clothes smoldering and peppered with holes. The walls bubbled with fire. Orozco ran for the exit, tripping over bodies, his eyes stung with acrid smoke. He made it outside and ripped off his smoldering jacket. Thank God he had his own car keys. He opened the door of his Mercedes and found a note on his seat next to a sugar candy skull. The note said, "They are watching. Never again." Orozco was whimpering. His hands couldn't work the keys. He heard sirens getting closer. He had to get away. He got in the car and slammed the door. He didn't know why he'd been spared. Perhaps he was too insignificant to the cartels. Perhaps they wanted him on their side, so they'd let him keep his life. He turned the ignition, and the steering wheel blasted apart. He was still alive when the paramedics found him. The police could identify him from his license plates and the ID in his wallet, which was fortunate. His face was hardly human. Later, the police described with grudging admiration how the bomber had rigged the airbag system, turning it into a bomb that delivered high-speed metal filament shrapnel rather than air. Orozco lived for 3 days, long enough to tell the police what had happened. He served the purpose the assassin required. He spread a warning to anyone else contemplating a break with his cartel employers. The assassin left no trace, aside from several other candy skulls strewn around the perimeter of the restaurant. The police were never able to find the man who delivered lunch. Orozco couldn't give a description. Orozco's mobile phone gave no information about where the call had been placed. It was this incident that led the media to give the assassin a name, Calavera, the Skull. Some were horrified by the assassin's efficiency. Some decided that criminals killing criminals was none of their concern, but everyone agreed. Calavera had earned his pay. He had as much capacity for mercy as the candy skulls he left in the Gatsby's parking lot, grinning up at the eyes of Dr. T.J. Eckelberg, like some kind of challenge. When I was done relaying the story to Maya, we were both quiet, listening to the storm outside. There wasn't much to say about Calavera. The story spoke for itself.
"You scuttled the boat," Maya said. "Why?"
"I don't want Calavera to get away."
"Why not?"
I didn't answer. She was right. It would have been easier to leave the killer and out. Let him brave the storm, hopefully sink to hell if he tried. Why would I want to cross a man like Calavera?
"You want to control the situation," Maya said. "It's not so much about the killer, is it? It's about Ralph again."
"It's always Ralph with you, isn't it?" Maya dug her toes into my ribs.
"I've got guilt too, but I handle it differently. I wouldn't try to stop my career. If I wasn't pregnant, I mean."
"Convenient excuse."
"Oh, yeah."
She winced as she rearranged her legs.
"So convenient. The point is, Ralph's death made you feel powerless. You don't want anything else to get out of your control. You tried leaving investigation completely, but now that you've got a killer on your hands, you can't stand the idea of him getting away from you. You're maybe not so different from Jesse Longoria."
"All right, now that was low."
"I'm wrong then?"
"Completely. Well, mostly."
"Ralph, I think, would have something to say about now."
"Yeah?"
Maya nodded.
"You're full of shit, Vato."
Her imitation was so good it made my heart soar. "That's irreverent."
"Ralph was irreverent. He was also right about a lot of things."
I pulled myself up next to Maya as best I could without jostling her. I kissed her forehead. If I didn't look down, I could almost imagine that she wasn't pregnant, like old times, before everything changed. Ralph's death and my decision to marry Maya weren't as simple as cause and effect, but they were connected emotionally. We both knew that. They resonated from the same terrible winter week. "I miss him," I said. Maya's breath was sweet and warm. Our forearms touched. The storm outside wailed steadily. I felt my eyes closing.
"Try to sleep," Maya told me. "You need the rest."
"Wake me up in an hour."
I will. I drifted off, imagining Ralph Arguello grinning above me, telling me I was a pretty sorry piece of work. In my dream, I was sitting on the back deck of Peter Brassus's house in Port Aransas. It was nighttime, New Year's Eve. Lights from the houses across the channel reflected like oil fire on the black water. On the edge of Brassus's dock, a little candy skull glittered. Peter had his computer in his lap, a vodka Collins in his hand. He was talking to me casually, telling me about his case against the drug cartel. I wanted to warn him. I knew his house would explode any minute, but my dream self felt it would be rude to interrupt. "It's all about emotional leverage," he told me. "What do they fear worse than their bosses? What makes them crumble inside? Find that, and they'll tell you what you want. They'll testify to anything." Peter had dark, glittering eyes, like the little skull on his dock. His skin was pale in the moonlight. When he lifted his glass to his lips, I said, "Shouldn't you get your family out of the house?" He glanced behind him. "Too late," he said sadly. "You can't control everything." Then I noticed the building behind us wasn't Brassus's house. It was the Rebel Island Hotel, and as the windows flared red, I realized that it wasn't Brassus's family in there. It was Garrett and Maya. "Here's to leverage." Peter Brassus lifted his glass to the flames. "Happy New Year, Trace."
"Trace!" Maya was shaking my shoulder. "Trace, I can't get up. You need to get it."
Someone was banging on the door.
"Navarro!"
I had no idea how long I'd been out. My eyes still burned from the fire in my dream. I stumbled out of bed and opened the door. Chase was standing there, looking like the ghost of keg parties past.
"We went for ice."
I blinked. "Chase, as direly important as that information is, why did you wake me up?"
"We found him."
His voice cracked with emotion.
"I think you'd better come see."
Chapter 20. Jose heard yelling from the floor below.
"It's in the kitchen," Imelda said.
"Yes," he said.
"We will stay here."
She bolted for the door, but he caught her arm.
"It can wait, Imelda. We have enough trouble."
She slumped down miserably on a stack of folded sheets. The linen closet was almost the size of a guest room. In the illumination of his flashlight, the shelves of folded sheets and towels reminded Jose of mummies, small bodies wrapped in white. He'd seen things like that in Mayan villages long ago in the Mexican army. He didn't like the memory coming back now.
"Señora Navarre asked for tea," Imelda murmured. "I told her I would bring her some."
"Will she give birth here?"
"I don't know."
Imelda shivered. The 20 years they'd been married, they'd lived in only hot places, but Imelda was always cold. Jose told her it was because her heart was so warm. Back home in Nuevo Laredo, she once cared for a dove with a broken leg for a month before it finally died. She'd cut moths in her hand and released them outdoors rather than kill them, and the children. The last day they'd gone to school, she had buttoned their shirts and fussed with their hair and slipped iced oatmeal cookies into their lunch bags.
"Jose,"
she said quietly.
"We can't."
"Don't say it," he warned. "It's your own fault." A tear traced her cheek. He didn't like being harsh with her, but the truth was the truth. Imelda had brought them so much trouble. Her warm heart again. She'd never understand that some broken birds would not heal. They would die, whether you cared for them or not. It was no mercy to prolong the pain. He knelt beside her and took her hands.
"We will survive this, mi amor. The storm will pass over."
She met his eyes, but he couldn't tell if she believed him. It seemed cruel to him that she had suffered with a husband like him. He wasn't worthy of her. He'd known that since the day they first met, at the dance at Senor Guerrero's ranch. They talked under the orange trees and watched the stars. She had been beautiful in her white dress. She'd seemed to him like an empty cup waiting to be filled with his stories. She found him fascinating, rough, perhaps a bit scary. She thought she could change him, make him into a good man. She had never given up on that idea. And he had married her anyway, knowing he would only bring her pain. But he just kept promising things would be better, and she kept believing. More noises came from the kitchen, distressed voices, the sounds of an argument. "We should go down," she said. "No," he told her. "Let them do what they will. They are like the storm, Miamor. Their sound means nothing." And they stayed in the linen room, holding hands, Jose kneeling before her as he had under the orange trees, telling her stories she chose to believe. Chapter 21. Never underestimate the resourcefulness of a college guy searching for booze. After ransacking the refrigerator looking for ice for Ty's head and, more important, beer, Chase and Marky found a storage room in the back of the kitchen with an industrial freezer. They decided to open the freezer on the theory that any self-respecting hotel would have vodka on ice. They were right. The vodka was wedged right between the corpse's feet. Chris Stowall lay curled in the fetal position, frost on his eyebrows. His skin was the same color as the ice-crusted sides of the freezer. Next to me, Benjamin Lindy muttered a curse that was probably shocking back in the 1940s. Apparently the old lawyer had gotten some sleep since I last saw him. His shirt was wrinkled, and his gray hair was mussed, but he still managed to look like the most dignified person present. He turned to Chase.
"Son, did you touch the body?"
No, sir.
But when Chase looked at me, I got the distinct impression he wanted to say something more. The bad boy attitude had drained out of his eyes. He looked like a kid who'd just been chased by the neighborhood pit bull. I noticed for the first time how he and Marky were dressed. The cutoffs and t-shirts and flip-flops were gone. Now they both wore jeans, hiking boots, dark long-sleeve shirts. Marky had a flashlight clipped to his belt. At Chase's feet, as if it had dropped there in a moment of panic, was a little hand shovel like a gardening trowel.
"Where were you two going?" I asked him.
Marky stepped between us.
"You've got a freaking dead man in the cooler, and you're asking stupid questions? Ty's already going nuts upstairs. If he hears about this..."
"I'm not upstairs." Ty was leaning against the cutting board, his hand a little too close to the butcher knives for comfort. His face was seasick green.
"Have me now, Navar," he demanded. His words were slurred. "We're stuck here, and this Calavera guy's gonna kill us all."
"Come on, man," Marky said. "That ain't gonna..."
"Shut up. Try to knock me out with those pills."
"Sedatives," Chase said defensively. Ty snorted.
"Told you we shouldn't have come. I told you something would go wrong. Couldn't get out, could you?"
"You gotta rest the head, dude." Marky's voice was cold. "Let me get you upstairs."
"Screw that."
Ty grabbed the knife, but he was too messed up to be dangerous to anyone but himself. Chase and Marky wrestled the cleaver away from him. They dragged him out of the kitchen, Ty still yelling that we were all going to die. I looked at Benjamin Lindy, who sighed.
"I believe those boys had one good idea."
Mr. Lindy pulled the chilled vodka out from between Chris Stowell's feet.
"May I buy you a drink?"
Lindy leaned into the freezer, putting his face nearer to Chris Stowell's than I would have done. The old man's breath turned to mist.
"Contusion on the back of the head," he decided. "That slick of blood you found earlier on the kitchen floor. I didn't find it."
This seemed a trivial point to argue, but I was running out of ways to distance myself. Lindy straightened.
"What would you say happened here?"
He was killed in the kitchen not long after Longoria was shot. Hit from behind, no struggle. Either someone sneaked up on him, or the killer was someone Chris knew. Someone he didn't fear turning his back to.
Someone reasonably strong, Lindy added. Strong enough to drag a grown man into this freezer.
Why go to the trouble of hiding the body and not clean the blood splatter on the kitchen floor?
No time. Perhaps the killer was interrupted, or perhaps he simply overlooked the blood.
I thought about that. A blood stain in the middle of a white floor seemed impossible to overlook, but I'd heard of crazier things. Convicted murderers would tell you that killing someone puts you in a daze. You might cover your tracks perfectly, except for something obvious. Your wallet on the kitchen counter, your coat across the arm of the victim's couch. The kitchen is a staff area, I said. The only people in here would be Chris, Alex, Jose, and Imelda.
And thirsty college students, apparently.
I nodded. I didn't like the way Chase and Markey had been dressed, or the fact that they tried to drug their friend.
The service entrance is right down the hall, I said. They were planning on sneaking out the back door.
That would be insane, Lindy said, unless they had a very compelling reason, like moving a dead body.
I shook my head. If that was the plan, why would Chase run up and get me?
I don't know, Lindy admitted. But if they were sneaking out for some other reason, what would make them check the freezer?
I didn't have a good answer, nothing logical. But somehow, that was the part of Chase's story I had no trouble believing. They really were looking for vodka, possibly to steal their nerves before whatever they were going to do. I looked down at Chris's cold face. I thought about the little seagulls he'd drawn in his diary, the picture of Waikiki Beach hanging on his dresser mirror.
Chris wasn't the guy you're looking for, I said, but he got tangled up with a killer somehow. I'll find him.
Lindy's hand trembled as he held his glass of vodka.
Your plan was to kill Calavera, I guessed. You were helping Longoria set some sort of trap for him.
Mr. Lindy raised his eyebrows.
You understand that I'll have to deny that. Chris Stoll and Longoria are both dead. Do you even care? Of course I care. I don't want any more death. Not for anyone innocent, at least.
I wanted to ask who, if anyone, Benjamin Lindy considered innocent, but I was interrupted by the sound of a woman's scream.
He's in there!
Lane shouted. She was on the floor behind Garrett's overturned wheelchair, pointing at her closet. Garrett was sprawled next to her, rubbing his head and looking disgruntled. In her panic, Lane had apparently tripped over him and toppled him out of his chair. Mr. Lindy and I shone our flashlights on the closet. The door was ajar, but there was no sign of movement, no noise.
"Who's in there?" I asked Lane. Her eyes were frantic and unfocused.
"Bobby! My ex. I saw him. We came in and he was right there in my closet."
I looked at Garrett. "I don't know, little bro," he grumbled. "I didn't see much. Lane backed into me. Next thing I knew, we were both on the floor. But there was movement in the room. Somebody was in here."
Mr. Lindy produced his .45 Colt Defender. Footsteps came tromping down the hall, and Alex Huff appeared in the doorway.
"What is it now?"
I shushed him, then followed Lindy toward the closet. The old man threw open the door.
"There's no one in here," he said.
"There was."
Lane looked at us like we were about to give her medication.
"I saw him."
"Okay," I said. "I believe you."
"Son," Lindy said uneasily.
"Check the bathroom," I suggested. Lindy did. He shook his head. No prowler in the room.
"All right," I said.
"Whoever he was, he's gone now."
"Who?"
Alex demanded. I looked at Mr. Lindy and gestured toward the door, hoping he'd get the hint. I figured the fewer men around Lane Sanford, the better.
"Come on, Mr. Huff," Lindy said. "There's something you need to see in the kitchen."
"Oh, that doesn't sound good," Alex said miserably.
but he allowed Mr. Lindy to lead him down the hall. I turned to Lane Sanford. "Why don't you sit down? I mean, on the bed." Garrett helped her up. He righted his wheelchair and climbed back into it, still looking disgruntled. For him, getting tipped out of his chair was about as bad as getting mugged, a complete violation of his dignity, such as it was. "Lane," I tried to sound soothing, "tell me exactly what you saw."
"My husband."
"Back up. You and Garrett were coming down the hall." She nodded. "Were you making much noise?" I asked. "Just talking," Garrett said, catching my meaning. "Nothing somebody inside the room could have heard over the storm." "Was the room locked?"
"Yes," Lane said. "I used my key."
I thought about that. A key didn't make much noise compared to a hurricane. If there had been someone in the room, he wouldn't necessarily have heard anything until Lane turned the handle. "Okay," I said. "So you opened the door and..."
"He was looking through my closet," Lane said. "The closet door was open."
"It was dark in the room?"
"Yes, I just had a flashlight. I shone it on him."
"You saw his face?"
"Well, no."
"What did you see of him?"
"A shape, but it was a man."
"Clothing, skin color?" She shook her head hesitantly.
"Dark shirt. Maybe that was just the shadows. I backed up into Garrett and dropped the flashlight."
"Hey, little bro, there was somebody in here," Garrett insisted.
"Is there any way he could have gotten past you out the door?"
"I don't see how," Garrett said.
I checked the closet. A garment bag hung on the rod, a pair of ladies' slip-on shoes, empty coat hangers, an ironing board on metal hooks, an extra pillow on the upper shelf. I checked the bathroom. Nobody was hiding behind the shower curtain. No one had dug an escape tunnel through the floor tiles. Back in the bedroom, nobody was hiding under the bed. The window was boarded over with plywood.
"Well, he vanished," I said. "He went up in smoke." "Secret passage?" Garrett asked. I stared at him. "I'm serious, little bro. This was a damn bootlegger's mansion during Prohibition. Ask Alex. They used to bring up cases of tequila from Mexico. You want to check for secret passages, be my guest."
Garrett huffed indignantly, rolled over to the closet, and started banging on the walls. I sat down next to Lane.
"From what you tell me, you didn't actually see your ex-husband."
She took a shaky breath.
"No one believes me."
"I believe your ex is a dangerous guy. But you couldn't tell if this person, whoever it was him."
I suppose it could have been someone else, another man, but..."
"Let's get you out of this room," I said, "for peace of mind." Garrett wheeled himself over, having unsuccessfully banged inside the closet, looking for a way to China.
"For once, my little bro has a good idea. Come on, Lane. I'll take you downstairs," I interrupted.
"We should try to get everyone together. I'll call the boys." Garrett glared at me.
"Why? What else is wrong?"
"The kitchen," Lane remembered. "Mr. Lindy was taking Alex to the kitchen."
Even in the dim illumination of my flashlight, I could tell her face had gone paler.
"It's Chris, isn't it?" she said. "You found him."
I didn't know any easy way to break the news, so I simply told her. Lane twisted the sheets in her hands.
"I want to see him."
"Not a good idea."
"No,"
Garrett agreed. "Lane, you don't need that."
"Chris didn't do anything," she said. "I got him killed. He tried to help me and..."
"Hey, stop that," Garrett said. "Come on."
She slipped off the bed and into his lap, pressing her head against his. She let out a sob and I lowered the flashlight. In the dark, they made a strange silhouette, like one large, misshapen person.
"You didn't do anything wrong," Garrett told her. "What happened to Chris isn't your fault. Neither is your bastard ex-husband. You did the right thing. You saw an out, and you took it."
I thought it was an out.
The shadows closed around us. The wind
battered the window. I didn't believe in ghosts, but this was a good room for them. If I'd been the first one through the door, I wondered what personal boogeyman I might have seen vanishing into the closet. "Come on," I told Garrett and Lane. "Let's get out of here." Chapter 22. Ty missed his gun. Marky pushed him into the bed and said, "Stay," like he was a dog. Ty wanted to shoot him. Chase glared down at him.
"You're worthless, man. Fucking worthless."
Ty's head still ached from where Marky had sapped him. His vision was blurry, and he wasn't sure exactly what drugs they'd given him. His claustrophobia was still smothering him, hot and heavy like an extra skin, but it was muted now. His nerves felt deadened.
"I'm sorry,"
he lied, trying to save himself another beating. Marky cursed.
"You belong in the freezer with Chris, dude."
"Don't say that. I panicked is all."
"Enough," Chase said. "This isn't helping."
Chase was still dressed in his dark clothes, his night run clothes. He paced at the foot of the bed, rubbing his knuckles. Ty wished he had his target pistol, and not just because he wanted to shoot them. The gun calmed him down. He only felt truly at peace at the firing range. Standing behind the cinder block partition on a cold winter morning, pistol in his hands. When he fired at targets, he had no anxiety. His hands didn't shake, and his skin didn't feel too heavy. He didn't need pills. His fear and anger were compressed into the barrel of the gun and fired right out of him. At least for a while. If he could just live on the firing range, life would be okay. But he always had to return to